Well, this evening we began the puja with chanting the Pangsakula chanting. This is the traditional chanting for those who have passed away, recently passed away, that they do customarily in this form in Thailand. And I feel it is it's significant and interesting also how this particular structure of the chanting, or this tradition, is say both designed to address the needs of those who stay behind, those who are still alive with bodies and breathing in this realm, and those who have passed away, so that those of you who are familiar with Pali or reading the translations, or familiar with the translations as we went along, will have reflected on that or seen that. Others may have just been following the sounds and not quite sure what was being said. But there's really two distinct parts to these passages that we chanted. The ones at the end, the last two, the Anicca Vata Sankhara and the Achirang Vata Yankayo, those two little chants at the end, they are more for us who are still breathing with bodies and alive in this realm, in the human world. The people who died that we were chanting for, in remembrance of, there was one or two that were quite aged, 87 years old or in their 70s. Kuncharasi, who had been ailing for a long time and passed away, not unexpectedly, her health had been fading for quite some time. But also Yom Gung's father, Kun Som Chai, had been in not great health, but certainly wasn't aware that he was close to dying, and went in to the hospital for a minor operation, and then something went awry. I'm not quite sure what the sequence of events were, but very unexpectedly, then he passed away. Similarly, this gentleman, Joseph, who passed away in India this morning, he was apparently, he was only known, he only knew he was ill about a couple of hours before he died, that he had a cyst in his brain, and so was apparently in quite good health, and then suddenly became terribly sick with diarrhea, and then went unconscious and died within a two-hour period. So extremely suddenly, 42 years old. So very suddenly, very unexpectedly for him. So these reflections that we chant at the end, these are for us that are still in the human realm. These are verses that say, Anicca Vata Sankhara, all conditioned things, all created, compounded things are of an impermanent nature, anicca. They are in a state of change. Anicca Vata Sankhara, Upada Vaya Damino. Having integrated, then they're subject to disintegration, Vaya Dhamma, that they fall apart. The natural result of coming together is separation. Upajitva Nirujanti. Having come into being, then they cease. Nirujanti is from Niroda, from cessation. Having begun, then they have to cease. But then the last line says, Te sang vupasamo sukho, which means in their passing is peacefulness or contentment, sukha, happiness. So that when that quality of anicca, of change, is truly, realized, is truly apprehended, appreciated, when it's seen that this is the intrinsic nature of all things, then the result of that seeing is peacefulness. It's not a sense of loss or the feeling that anything has gone wrong or anything shouldn't be this way. It's a recognition of, oh, this is how it is. Nature is following its natural course. Nothing has gone wrong. The other chant, the Achirang Vata Yankayo, is translated something along the lines of, "Not long, alas, and it will lie, this body here upon the earth, hollow, void of consciousness, and useless as a rotten log." So that's a little bit more blunt. "Not long, alas, and it will lie, this body here upon the earth, hollow, void of consciousness, and useless as a rotten log." So this is, in a way, helping to us to say, view and examine, explore our feeling of identification with the body, with this physical form that is here, that we take to be who and what we are, and that we take to be so real, so solid, so permanent. And yet we, in that identification with our personality, with our vitality, with our capacity to act and see and feel and think and do, then we miss the fact that this is just a collection of organic matter woven together in this miraculous fashion, so that it is a basis for consciousness, and it's an apparently independent and separate entity. But yet, if we study the biology, we look at the physical reality of it, and when we are able to appreciate a dead body of a human being, then we realize, oh, it's just carbon, oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, all the different elements, hydrogen, all the way up to the heavy elements, the complex molecules, from the most simple to the most complicated, woven together to form this body, to form the organic matter of our physical form. And at a certain point, that which is integrated, that which has come together, is necessarily going to disintegrate. It's not something special or separate or somehow outside of the laws of nature. And so you have this rather blunt phrase, hollow, void of consciousness and useless as a rotten log. Well, again, if we study biology, we know that rotten logs are not useless at all. The fungi really appreciate a dead tree. They flourish in rotten logs. And it's also said in California, where I was living for a number of years, that a fallen redwood tree supports something like 20 times the amount of life forms that a standing and living redwood tree does. So that a dead redwood tree, quote unquote, is actually far more useful in a broader sense than a living one. But still, from the point of view of the entity itself, this body, this physical form, when the life force fades and it's no longer living or functioning as an independent entity, then it's like a fallen log. It's like a kind of collection of organic matter that no longer has an independent will, no longer has an individual consciousness. It's going to go. It's going to be this way for all of us. Now, these kind of reflections, they can be very threatening to our ego, to the habits of self-view, that those, say, very strong instinctual drives within us that say, I am an individual person, I am this body, I am this character, this is who and what I am. And we need those instincts, and we need those patterns of thinking, and those attitudes, they are necessary for our functioning, our survival as a communal animal living together with other beings and in the human society. Those are useful patterns, useful habits, but it's important to recognize that these are convenient fictions, that these are, say, that they are half-truths that we use. And it's only when we buy into them, we believe them to be absolute truths, that I really am this independent person and I have the right to be alive and comfortable and mobile and be able to think straight and hear and see and feel and digest without obstruction, without difficulty, without discomfort. When we make those presumptions, when we take that for granted, that as a human being, I have the right to not be ill, to always be comfortable, to be able to move around and do the things I like. When we make that presumption, that's when we create the cause of suffering, when we see that this body, this this life of ours, is part of an intricate and infinitely complex web of being, constantly breathing, taking in oxygen, breathing out carbon dioxide, taking in food and excreting the waste products. When we see that we are in a continual relationship with the greater living universe, the greater living world, then we have a better perspective on it. So these last chants are the last these two verses there for those of us to take this, the fact of this other friend, this associate, or someone who's been in our family or part of our world that has now died, they've now gone on, is taking the fact of their death, the ending of their life, and say, employing it, plowing that event back into our consciousness. Say, well, look, yeah, here it is. This is the fact of life, that one day it's going to come to an end. So look, bring this to mind, let this into the heart, and let that guide and inform your decisions, your choices. Just a couple of days ago, when I was also talking about other friends of ours in the United States, a man who's just been diagnosed with quite advanced leukemia, and his daughter-in-law has also had some major physical problems, just got three young children, and they're talking about the difficulties that family was experiencing. Yeah, I was reflecting on these very same teachings and talking about it, and say how, you know, that yes, there's a sense of threat or a sense of loss or an anxiety when that comes up, a feeling of grief and sadness. Just talking about these matters, it makes us feel kind of tense and glum, doesn't it? Like, rather like the English November weather, sort of a bit sort of grey and cold and threatened and uncomfortable. Yeah, that's when we talk about these dark matters, as it were, it has that effect on the heart. It's a bit chilling and a bit threatening, but it's important to recognize that it's threatening to our sense of ego. It's threatening to our sense of independence or our habits of self-view. But the Buddha really encouraged us to look at this, just like with these verses that we chant here. It's not to make ourselves miserable, but rather to help ourselves to wake up and to really be alert to our life, and to, in a mysterious way, to actually learn how to enjoy it even more, to really be present for it. So I was reminded how just after Abhayagiri Monastery was opened, it was the monastery opened up in June of 1996, and I've been leading the project to found a branch monastery over there in the States, and had over 5 or 6 years been putting a lot of effort and attention into helping for a community to develop. And then we were given this very wonderful piece of land, this forested land, by Master Xuanhua, donated 120 acres of forest that became the starting sort of initial piece of land that became the core of the monastery property, was given by Master Hua. And so it was the place was a long time in preparation, a long time in say the process of forming. So 5 or 6 years I've been moving towards this monastery opening. Finally, we were given the land. We were able to buy the place next door and get with a little house on it, and to launch the whole project. And that was in June of 1996. And then in September, or maybe it was early October of 96, then I was diagnosed with melanoma, which is kind of virulent skin cancer. So in sunny California, that's really inconvenient. You might think that having the sunshine and blue, wall-to-wall blue skies for 6 or 7 months of the year would be something very attractive, but suddenly being diagnosed with skin cancer was very, really threw the experience into a different light. And the interesting thing was that I had this a mole on my shoulder that had sort of mutated, and so they sent me in to have a visit to the local dermatologist. And so he took one look and literally said, "You know, lie down," and got out the anesthetic and then and excised the errant mole right then and there. So it was obviously made an impact on the dermatologist that without sort of pausing in movement, he sort of took one look, said lie down, and got his scalpel out. Well, actually, he got his camera out first, took a picture, and then he got the scalpel out. So then it was a week between when he took the sample and made the initial diagnosis and then sent it off to the lab when the results came back from the lab. So during that week, it was an extremely interesting, capital I, interesting time. Because in those prior months, my mind had been filled with starting the new monastery and having this new project and where we were going to build all the kutis, and Ajahn Pasno was going to be coming in a couple of months' time, and all of the arising part of the cycle. It was all beginning and new, and it was an interesting project, and I was responsible for a lot of bringing things together and giving it direction, and all these sort of plans of how we were going to develop the land and where we might put this building or that building, and where we might put kutis. And suddenly, there was a different story in the picture. And just by chance or by circumstance, the year before, one of the main people, the most involved people in the group in San Francisco, had also been diagnosed with melanoma. And she'd been told that it was recurrent, that she'd had melanoma before, and so now that it had come back, that there's a particular pathology or particular way that melanoma works. It's a unique kind of cancer, so that if it returns, then it's untreatable. So it comes back in such a way that there's no treatment possible for it, and so it's definitely going to be terminal. So the previous year, she'd been told that she had this recurrent melanoma and that she was probably not going to live until Christmas. So I'd spent a lot of time the previous year counseling her and giving advice and helping her to deal with this. And then also then later on in the year, finding out that she had been misdiagnosed. So that she hadn't had melanoma the first time, but she did have it in the second time. So yes, she had the cancer, but it was not going to be fatal. She just had to keep out of the sun and to protect herself with sunscreens and such like. So I'd become quite melanoma conscious the year before, and suddenly there was a likelihood that I had it too, and had no idea how advanced it might be. So it could be that it's a fairly slight, or it could be that it was very advanced. And if it's even if you get it the first time, if it's already past stage four or stage five, then stage five melanoma is kusala dhamma akusala dhamma, so it's the appropriate treatment. But even if it was stage four, there's not much you can do at that point. My understanding of this. So there was no real way to tell exactly how far, if it was malignant or how far it was advanced. So during that week, between the time I had the initial diagnosis and the tests came back from the lab, it was a very interesting week. Because suddenly all of my list of things to do, all the things that I was in the middle of in terms of founding this new monastery, this monastery was 3 or 4 months old, suddenly what was it worth? What did it really matter? Ajahn Pasno actually wasn't going to be able to come from Thailand at all. Maybe if he did come, then he'd think it was too much to leave the place on his own, or there wasn't going to be a monastery at all. It was all, if I popped off, then it would all fall apart, and there would be no monastery. There would just be the forest and the hillside, and the place and the project, and everything would just dissolve as an idea, as a possibility. Or the various different responsibilities and projects I had in terms of say books I was writing, or the other commitments that I had for teaching and plans that I had for the coming year. Suddenly, all of that was just smoke and shadows. It just, well, what does it matter? Is it really there? What substance did it really have? These were just ideas or possibilities or potentialities. There was really nothing there. There was no thing there. And so then in that week, it was, even though it was very interesting in particular, because as Buddhist monastics, you know, we're always talking about the contemplations of death and anicca, impermanence and uncertainty. But it really makes a difference when it's got your name on it. Let me tell you. Suddenly, it's not, when it's not theory and you're sort of discoursing and explaining about, well, it's good to contemplate death and we have to look at anicca. And we say these things, you know, we might love these teachings and admire them. But when it's got your name on it, when it's got the Amaro Bhikkhu on the lab report, then it's a very different story. And so it was a wonderful experience of having my priority list shaken up, really just reordered. And then that sense of, okay, what's really important here? What really matters? What am I carrying around as unfinished business? What are my hopes? What are my regrets? What are my resentments? What are my fears, my desires? What's still being carried around? If I'm going to be dead by Christmas, what do I want to be carrying around? What's unfinished here? So I began to realize that in that week, oh, this is why we have these as subjects for frequent recollection. This is why we bring it to mind, so we can really get a perspective on our priority list, the things that the mind is preoccupied with, our plans, our projects, our resentments, our unrequited loves, our sort of mistakes that we've made in the past that we're still carrying around. You know, how much are they worth? How important is it for us to keep sustaining them or protecting them or cherishing them? So even though we say these words, we recite these verses and they are familiar to us, we have the five subjects for frequent recollection. I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, and so on. You know, that we can get so familiar with these, they just sort of slide off us like, you know, water rolling off a duck's back, or, you know, off a duck's back if you're in Britain, or off a lotus leaf if you're in Thailand. It just sort of rolls off without having any kind of substantial effect. But it really makes a difference if we allow it into the heart and we allow those teachings, those realizations to shake up our priority list and to really help us to say, okay, what am I carrying around? What are my plans for next year? What are the books that I'm in the middle of writing? What are the things I'm going to do with this building or with heading towards becoming a novice or a nun or an agarika? What do I think I'm in the middle of? Or what am I heading towards? And to see, well, actually what really matters is what's in our heart right now. What are we carrying around right now? And what can we let go of right now? And this is why that these reflections, even though they might seem bitter on the outside, they're very sweet on the inside. As one of Master Hua's frequent quotations is like the a kind of motto of the Chinese Dutanga tradition, the Chinese ascetic practice tradition, is bitter practice, sweet mind. Bitter practice, sweet mind. So that the flavor of these kind of reflections can seem quite bitter, but the result of that, letting that into the heart, is that it leaves an aftertaste of sweetness. There's a sweetness, a delight of freedom that remains as we allow them in. So the first part of the chanting, though, is for the benefit of those who have passed away and are embarking on their next life and their next round of existence. And so the thinking behind these particular verses, reciting these passages from the Abhidhamma, these analytical teachings, this is what I've been told as the basis for this, or why these are chanted for those who have passed away, In a way, it's giving the benefit of the doubt to those who have just passed away, that they have been reborn up in the heavenly realms. Because the legend in the Buddhist histories, Buddhist mythology, is that 7 days after the Bodhisattva was born, and his mother, Queen Mahamaya, passed away, and she was reborn in one of the heavenly realms, in the Tusita heaven, and so that the Tavatimsa heaven, excuse me, and. So the one time after the Buddha's enlightenment, then it's said that he ascended up into the Tavatimsa heaven for that the duration of that rains retreat, and then spent that time teaching the Devata who used to be his mother. And what he taught her was Abhidhamma, because the principle being that Devatas have such a refined existence that when you talk about dukkha, when you talk about unsatisfactoriness or suffering, they can't understand what you mean, because their experience, their moment-to-moment experience is so continually pleasant, various different kinds of pleasantness, that the whole concept of suffering or unsatisfactoriness is extremely hard for them to comprehend. So rather like someone who's born into a very comfortable circumstances, they're in a wealthy family, they have surrounded by loving people, and everything is fortunate, supportive, comfortable, affirming, and they don't have any kind of physical diseases, and that you might say, well, life has got some very unpleasant, unsatisfactory sides to it. They say, what do you mean? How can you say that? Life is great. I love it. You know, it's good that there's a kind of drunkenness, sort of drunk on good fortune and pleasantness, and a kind of complacency. So that someone who is born into a sort of wealthy, privileged, comfortable situation with very also this psychologically supportive and helpful. Can in a way that's like a deva-like existence here in the human world. So it's said that the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma, or spoke in that way, analyzing experience into its microscopic or sub-microscopic detail, to say, well, this is how experience is formed, to be able to teach the Devata who had been his mother, so that she'll be able to understand the Four Noble Truths and to be able to be liberated. So the first part of the chanting, the Kusala Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma, it's going through the categories that you find. In a way, it's like the chapter headings of the Abhidhamma teachings. So Kusala Dhamma, wholesome qualities. Akusala Dhamma, unwholesome qualities. Abhyakata Dhamma, neutral qualities. Or Ajata Dhamma, external phenomena. Bahida Dhamma, internal phenomena, external phenomena. Ajata Bahida Dhamma, both internal and external phenomena. So it's going through the different categories of experience and sort of spelling them out bit by bit. So that by using the intellect and the quality of intelligence, the capacity of the mind to recognize patterns and to understand through analysis, through exploration and intelligence, then the idea being that that's a spiritual method that can help to arrive at a quality of realization. That's the appropriate form of teaching for those in the deva realms. So that's why, I've been told, this is why we chant the Abhidhamma, these particular sets of teachings. The pachayas, the hetu pachayo, aramana pachayo, these are the 24 links, or the ways that one condition can affect another. So that when you're considering the law of causality, in what they call idapachayata, the way that this conditions that, or this one thing affects another, the Buddha went into extraordinary refined detail. It's not just that A causes B or A affects B, but that kind of different causing or affecting or having an impact upon that causality, the relatedness of one thing to another, there's 24 different ways that can be done, and I won't attempt to try and go into that in any detail, but just that chant that we do, Hetu Pachayo, Aramana Pachayo, is describing those 24 different patterns of causal relationships about how one thing can affect another. So this is all very, refined analytical teaching, but the custom of reciting it is, to whatever extent possible, you're trying to help equip the being that has passed on to a different realm. You're sort of giving them the kind of roadmap for the mind, the roadmap for consciousness and how mind and the material world, the inner and external worlds, are functioning in relationship to each other. Exactly how much that might help an individual, you might say, well, hang on a minute, how can that be helping? But I'm just spelling out or explaining why there is that custom that we chant that. Now we might also reflect on this whole mixture of teachings and consider, well, how can this be useful to us? Why might this be, helpful to reflect upon? Those of us who spent much time listening to Lumpur Sumedho over the years and listened to his Dhamma talks, we have so many recordings of that, very accessible to everybody nowadays. One of the things that he often said useful to consider is, he say, as a human being, we have the body of an animal, but the mind of a god. So this body is an animal body. It breathes, it eats, it has urges towards sexual reproduction, it has urges towards protecting territory, to bonding together socially with other beings of its own species, or fending off unwanted members of its own species. It's an animal body. It's fully connected to the material world. So we experience this animal body, but also the mind of a god. We have the capacity to remember. We have the capacity to think. We are able to generate qualities of loving kindness, of compassion. We have these extraordinary expansive abilities. We can empathize with other beings. We can feel compassion for beings outside our own species. We can have compassion for ants and midges and all the other beings of the world, or even beings of other worlds. The capacity to generate goodwill and kindness, compassion towards all beings. These are divine and extraordinarily refined qualities. So the reason why, or one of the useful reflections on considering why we would bring these kind of teachings to mind at the end of a life, is to be able to, in a sense, fully appreciate that blend of experience, and to also fully appreciate the human condition, that having the body of an animal and the mind of a god is really the prime territory for understanding. And they say, this is why Buddhas are always born in the human world. At least in Theravada mythology, you never find a Buddha appearing in the Deva world, or a Buddha being born as an animal or in the lower realms. In the hell realms, Buddhas are always appear, that the Buddhahood is realized in the human realm. And it's precisely because that the human realm is got such a wonderful mixture of both the pleasant and the painful. Because the animal world, animal realm is a realm that's painful, it's difficult. I know people like to exalt the animal realm somewhat, particularly in the West, and nowadays they can almost deify the sort of animals as being kind of pure innocent spirits, but if we observe the animal realm and see how animals function in relationship to each other, it's a brutal realm. It's a realm that is guided almost entirely by instinct, the desire for food, the protection of territory, the competition with others of your own species to be the the top dog, or to protect your territory, to fend off competitors. It's an instinctual and brutal realm. There is a really I think it was the philosopher Hobbes described the nature of life: nasty, brutish, and short. The animal realm, that's the kind of bluntness and coarseness, the harshness of animal existence, that there's not a lot of capacity for reflection or for restraint. Not a lot of compassion is possible for even beings outside your own immediate sort of brood, or let alone other species, even though there's occasional instances of that. So if we look upon the animal realm, we see it's a realm that is painful, is very confined, very limited, guided by instincts towards violence, towards sexual reproduction, towards territory, towards competitiveness, and the strength of those instinctual drives can completely dominate the mind, can rule the whole picture. So we have an animal body, so we experience those instincts. We all inherit that as part of our physical being, part of our existence as human beings. But having not been born completely as animals, or not sort of sunk in the animal realm, we also have those higher faculties. We have the capacity for wisdom, the capacity for compassion, the capacity for loving kindness, the capacity for mindful awareness that can observe the states of mind. We can observe fear, we can observe aggression, we can observe jealousy or territoriality, protection of my patch. When you come into the temple and say on the observance night, and then someone has taken your cushion, the place where you like to sit, and someone has it's taken my space. We're able to observe the rising of that rage, or that sense of ownership or territory. Like, how dare you? I always sit there. How can you? How can they move my stuff and plant themselves there? That's my spot. That's a wonderful thing. It's a marvelous thing. The Deva realms, having the mind of a god, as I said, the Buddhahood is always, at least in the Buddhist mythology, is always in the southern Buddhist world, Buddhahood is always realized in the human realm. That it's the last birth of a Buddha is always as a human being, not as a devata or as an animal, even though they might have, during the course of their bodhisattva career, if you read the Jataka stories or other Buddhist mythology, then the bodhisattvas have many, many lives as devas, as gods, as animals, or in different realms of being. But Buddhahood, that last life, arahantship, is always realized in the human realm. And the understanding has also been that, as I've said about the devata who had been the Buddha's mother, that up in the deva realms, the consciousness is too refined. It's too enjoyable. The dukkha is not obvious enough. It's too hard to really discern dissatisfaction, to really meet that and know that in a very direct and clear way, so that it's in this realm of a human being where we have this mixture of the animal body and the divine mind, this capacity for great radiance and wisdom, this capacity for incredible nobility and self-sacrifice, you know, drawing upon those sort of noble and divine qualities of mind. This is the richest zone. So just as in the evolution of life upon Earth, they say that the evolution of complex life, it was mostly dependent on what they call the warm tide pools, or at the edges of the sea where the sea meets the land, and the in those pools of water where they were warmed by the sun and there's enough moisture, but also say connected to the land and the nutrients coming from the land and the soil. This is where complex life was most fully and rapidly able to develop, in the what they call the littoral zone, the borderland between the sea and the shore. Yeah, that's where is the sort of the richest zone for biological development. So the human realm is like that same littoral zone between the animal realm and the God realm. It's where those two meet, like the sea, where the sea and the land meet. So this is where the animal instincts and the divine capacities meet each other. And in that meeting point, in that sort of the warm tide pools of the human realm, this is where we can most say directly meet the quality of dukkha. We can meet the effects of aversion, of desire, of fear, of hope. We can meet that and know that and learn from that, and that and this is where the liberation is most conveniently and directly realized. So this morning at the breakfast time, I was quoting Master Hua again. And well, both Master Hua and Lumpur Cha, where Lumpur Cha said something like, anyone who enters upon the practice of the Dhamma should expect to experience great friction and difficulty. That's intrinsic in that entering into Dhamma practice, that we shouldn't expect everything to be a smooth ride, or think that if we're practicing properly, then everything will be just like floating downstream with and in fact that practicing Dhamma involves friction and difficulty, going against the stream. Master Hua's phrase was, the Buddha Dharma arises from difficulty. The more difficult, the better. So oftentimes when we meet with difficulty, we experience the desire for something that we can't have, or the desire for something that we can have, and then we get it, and then we feel disappointed or regret that we got it. Or we experience the fear of something that is taken to be threatening. We experience aversion, negativity towards something that we dislike, can't get away from. Living with people that we don't feel comfortable with, or living with mind states mental habits of endless internal chattering, or feelings of fear or jealousy, regret or agitation, doubt, that we can take these, we call them hindrances, nivarana, but we think of them as uncomfortable or irritating obstructions. But it's important to recognize that if we are wise, then those very things that are we are obstructed by, that are causing friction and difficulty, then that's exactly where we are able to develop true wisdom. We're able to see the habits of attachment, the habits of identification. And that's exactly where we can we need to let go. We need to see what those habits are, and in seeing them, then they can be let go of. We can see, oh, this is association with the disliked. I'm now being with what I don't want, so therefore dukkha. Separation from the liked. okay, this is dukkha, appiyehi sampayogo dukkho, association with the disliked. This is what I didn't want. Here it is. Ow! Okay, because of this, there is that. This is the cause, that's the effect. Aha. So it's still painful, it's still what we don't like, but in seeing that causal relationship, then we're able to recognize, oh, this is the law of nature. This is disliked, and there's the experience of it, therefore painfulness. Aha, this is functioning according to the laws of nature. This is the law of causality. Because of this, there is that. Aha. And in seeing that, in that moment of seeing, in that quality of awareness, of vijja, then the heart is free of it. So part of the Abhidhamma chanting that we recite, and maybe you think, well, this is just sort of folk belief or just kind of custom or tradition, or it's not particularly helpful just to be reciting these categories or chapter headings, but these are extremely useful to reflect on and bring to mind. And particularly in that chanting, we recite what's called the Vipassana Bhumi, or the bases of insight. And this was Lumpo Cha's favorite chant, so that when he was in a state of paralysis, he couldn't speak or move for 10 years, then Ajahn Pasano, when he was the abbot of Wat Pananacha, the international monastery, he made the custom of going around every week on the observance day, like today, the half moon day. He would take a whole group of the monks and novices from Wat Pananacha, go to Wat Bapong, and they would sit outside of Ajahn Chah's kuti, and he would be there in his wheelchair, looked after by the nursing monks. And they would gather together and they would recite the same chant, the Vipassana Bhumi, Pancha Kanda Rupa Kandho, and so on. Because this was Lumpo Cha's favorite verses. Not because they're particularly inspiring or poetic, but because they are, in a sense, going through these qualities that support contemplation and reflection. They're listing and say, bringing together these patterns of analysis that support insight, looking at the five khandhas, the patterns, the aspects of body and mind, looking at the six senses, how perception works, and particularly looking at the Four Noble Truths and the dependent origination, the how, because of ignorance, then that is the direct cause of the quality of tanha or craving, how ignorance conditions the way that perception is experienced, how that leads to craving and clinging and towards dukkha, how it leads to dissatisfaction, the feeling of alienation, separateness, and dukkha, suffering, how that leads to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And in that recitation of the dependent origination, again, we might take it just to be listing of categories and some kind of empty Pali formula, but it's also significant that this was what the Buddha presented as the real core insight. This is the real engine of liberation, if you like. If this can be understood, if this can be truly known, then this is the direct means whereby the heart is liberated. It's that the fine analysis of the Four Noble Truths is right there in the pattern of dependent origination. So, again, those of you who've spent much time with Lumpo Sumedho or have read Dhamma books or listened to his talks, you know that he spent a huge amount of time analyzing and exploring the law of dependent origination. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, every winter retreat, he would spend for a few years, every retreat, every teaching during the entire 3 month retreat, would be on dependent origination, different aspects of it, on either the avijja paccaya sankhara, ignorance conditions sankhara, or ignorance complicates everything, as he would put it, or the nature of the sense, the six senses and contact and feeling, salayatana pasavedana, or the nature of craving and becoming and rebirth, tanha upadana bhava. So there's he would explore these in great detail and encourage this kind of contemplation of, what do these terms refer to? How do we experience that? Because far from being just sort of empty categories of Abhidhamma, these are talking about why you and I are not happy, why you and I and all of us don't experience freedom, why the heart is bound by love and hate, success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss. You know, why we are, experiencing dissatisfaction, why we are not, fully content and at ease and free in this experience of living. So these are really important and useful teachings to comprehend, particularly the relationship between feeling and craving, to really know the difference between feeling, liking and disliking, and craving, the quality of wanting or not wanting, to explore those, to know those. But also, and maybe most importantly, right at the root, avijja paccaya sankhara, when there is ignorance, when there is avijja, when there is no vijja, then the whole cycle kicks off. That's the cause of all feelings of self and other, alienation, the feelings of insecurity, feelings of unhappiness and incompleteness. Avijja, that's the seed of the whole thing. And as we recite this, that the turning point of that of the teaching, as it says, avijaya taveva asesa viraga niroda, with the complete cessation of avijja, when there is no avijja, when there's no ignorance, then there is no sankhara. Sankharas cease, they don't arise. There's no coming into being. So again, this is a very central element of Lumbo Sumedho's teaching, is that if there is vijja, if there's that quality of knowing, of awareness, there's a full and, comprehensive, intuitive awareness of in the present, then the problems don't arise. Ignorance complicates everything. When there's no ignorance, there's no complication. when there is awareness, then we don't cause any problems within ourselves or within others. When there is the heart is grounded in that quality of knowing, of awareness, then in a sense all our troubles cease. The world is no longer seen in terms of self and other. We're no longer framing things in terms of success and failure, gain and loss, good and bad, right and wrong. There is a quality of integration and a quality of stability, a quality of invulnerability. There's an unshakable freedom that's in the heart, as long as that quality of awareness is present. When that is, the heart is fully grounded in being able to know, oh, this is a feeling of liking, this is a feeling of disliking, this is a feeling of sweetness, this is a feeling of bitterness, this is the experience of arising and gaining and becoming, this is the feeling of falling, of losing, of ending. Here it is, it feels like this. So that in a way is the most sort of radical and complete way of using the teachings on dependent origination, is to establish the heart in knowing, in that intuitive awareness, that full open-hearted knowing here in this present moment, knowing the sense world, knowing the realm of feeling, seeing it arising, passing away, doing its thing, and that a complete and full knowing of that, then right in this very moment, if that is seen, then the heart is freed right here. This is how the cycle of birth and death is ended. It's escaped from. So that we often talk about the dependent origination as the bhava chakra. You've often seen these traditional images of the wheel of the six realms of the heavenly realm, the human realm, the animal realm, the ghost realm, the asura realm, and so on, the six realms of existence, and then the 12 links of dependent origination around the outside, and then it's being held up by Mahakala, the god of time, great time, Mahakala. So that's known as that wheel, is known as the Bhavachaka, the wheel of becoming, and so that the way that is, the heart is freed from that is through this very quality of awareness, the quality of vijja. If there is vijja, then there is no bondage to that Bhavachaka. The heart is free from that. That becoming, freed from that cycle, it's not born into that. So that if we are, say, hearing this, taking this to heart, then it's not just a kind of Buddhist philosophy or some kind of collection of traditional terms or say, Buddhist forms, but we're actually applying this here and now. Knowing this very moment, the sounds, the feelings in the body, the thoughts and moods in the mind, we're knowing this. Oh, this is just as patterns of nature, coming and going, changing. And in that moment of vijja, then the bhavachaka is not born. There is no birth and death to be brought to an end. It's the heart at that moment is freed from time. It's out of the grip of Mahakala. It's not in the grip of the realm of time. It's not under the laws of birth and death. It's free of that. The heart is, independent, free of reliance upon anything. So this is the capacity that we have, and these teachings point to this, so that the encouragement then in hearing these teachings or reciting these verses, and to see we have these as customs, we have these as forms and traditions, but they have a purpose, they have a real core of meaning, and the meaning, the value, is this actual quality of liberation, the freedom of the heart. That's the core of it, that's the realization of that is the purpose of it. So if we really want to make use of these customs and forms and traditions, we put them to work in this way. We pick them up and explore them, and actualize what they're referring to, and then we experience the benefits of that. And that they're far from being just a formal ritual that you do because somebody's passed away, that we're taking this and applying it and using it to carry out the purpose that the Buddha taught in the first place. We're bringing that into our own lives to be of benefit. To bring that quality of liberation into being, to be something that's known, that's of a direct benefit to us and to all beings that we come in contact with. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.